Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
This episode is brought to you by Roberta's, home of Heritage Radio Network for 10 years. Learn more about Roberta's at robertaspizza.com.
As the news of coronavirus reverberates throughout the world, we at HRN are especially concerned about how coronavirus will impact our food system. We will use our platform to support the restaurant, agriculture, hospitality, and other food-related industries by maintaining our coverage and operations. As social distancing becomes the temporary norm, podcasts are more important than ever. There's never been a more crucial time to stay informed about the state of our food system and the way that food connects our global community. We're sharing all of our COVID-19 coverage at heritageradionetwork.org/COVID-19. From interviews with nonprofit leaders and journalists, to firsthand accounts from chefs and restaurant owners, to reports on how the crisis is affecting regional farms. Our team is working remotely from all over to keep food radio alive. HRN needs your support more than ever to keep sharing essential stories and resources with our listeners. Make a donation of any amount. Visit heritageradionetwork.org/donate.
Welcome to HRN Happy Hour. It's 5 o'clock somewhere, and somewhere is all across the country. I'm Kat Johnson, your host. I am in Alabama drinking a vodka martini because I don't have any gin. And I'm here, I'm here with my co-host and the crew. We have Katie Mosman-Wadler. Hello, Katie.
Hey, Kat. I'm in Connecticut drinking tea.
Drinking tea. We have Hannah Forden.
Hello, hello. I am in New Jersey sipping on a Tanqueray and tonic.
Ooh.
Sorry, Kat, I've got the gin.
You have the gin. We have Dylan Hoyer.
Hello, I'm in Western Mass having a, I don't have a name for it yet, but it has mezcal, maple syrup, and lemon juice.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
If you have name suggestions, definitely let me know.
Mezcal, maple. Okay.
I think you should do like an acronym, like a mmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmmm Nailed it. Okay, moving on.
Or sorry. Like Vermont and Oaxaca.
Oh.
Oh, that's good.
Flannel in Oaxaca.
Oaxacan in Vermont.
Flannel in Oaxaca should be on a menu in Brooklyn. I mean, back when there were
menus. You heard it here first.
We have Matt Patterson, whose voice you just heard.
Just opened an IPA. I'm feeling great.
Nice. And our guest of honor this week is a very good friend of the podcast, a very good friend of the network, John DeBerry. Welcome, John.
Hi. Thanks for having me. I'm in my closet in Lower Manhattan drinking seltzer.
He's so profesh.
A true podcaster.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What you do. So today we have a lot to talk about with John. The first and most exciting thing, I mean, I think, John, you tell me, you have a book coming out very soon.
Indeed, I do. It's called Drink What You Want, and it's a cocktail book. And it's been so many years in the making that, like, it's almost, like, surreal that it's finally happening, you know? It's like when you start college, like, you never imagine you graduate, and then you're like, oh, crap, like, this happened. So I'm kind of adjusting to the reality of people being able to read it out in the world, and getting very excited and, like, a little scared, like, when you put something out there and, like, people can read what you say and they can disagree with you, or, you know, so it's a really interesting experience to get to have so much work that you put in a lot of time into that then just gets, like, delivered to someone's house and then they can dive in. So I'm, like, eagerly anticipating all the deliveries that are happening next week.
I can't wait to get my coffee. I'm so excited. We have been seeing some sneak peeks of what the book is going to look like. And can you talk a bit about the artwork and just, I don't even know if you can describe it, but just sort of the thought process behind it and what people can expect. I mean, this is going to be so different from beauty shots of cocktails on a bar.
Totally. And it was funny because I wanted to have illustration was always like from day one. I was like, I want to do illustrations. I want to maybe do like a comic book, like an anime. Like I had all kinds of like really zany ideas that had to be reined in. But like to me, the whole point of the book was about how like you don't have to do this exact thing in order to be happy. That you have these sort of like a gentle framework for your own drinks, and if it's you're only really pleasing yourself and your friends, and like, you know, you have a little bit of freedom. And so to have these very explicit images that were like real pictures just kind of seemed antithetical to the whole thing. Plus I feel like a lot of what drink photography is has to do with the glassware or the really elaborate garnishes. And there's that to me felt a little bit, just personally, like I feel like I've seen it before, and being able to have more creativity in terms of just like the way that you present like a visual image, was really important to me to express like more mood. And like, it wasn't really so much about like, oh, did you pick the right beautiful mint leaves to look just like this really elaborate glass that costs $500, you know? It's like, no, it's like a sketchy, like fun representation of what it could look like, but it doesn't have to. You're not going to be arrested if it doesn't look exactly like that. So I use that as a way of getting that point across of just kind of this freedom. And I also wanted to I wanted to visually appear in the book as well. So I thought it'd be really weird to have like photos of me doing stuff. I don't know why, but I thought it would just be cool to have like a more interpretive representation of myself. So we found this amazing illustrator in the UK. Her name is Sarah Tennant Jones. And I gave her, we just sort of let her run with it and just came back with these amazing images. And I feel like she, even though she and I, like, we've barely even talked on the phone, like she just captured my essence so well. It was just really amazing to have that partnership. And it just came out really, really cool. And it's like the gift that keeps on giving from all these pictures. And like, I haven't even posted like a lot of them because I'm trying to like save, you know, some nuggets for when people actually get the book in hand. And there's just like, yeah, it's just really, just a great thing to have.
Yeah.
Can you talk about your feeling desperate chapter?
Well, it's very timely. Yeah. So
prescient.
It's, you know, I feel like having like a chronic anxiety disorder, you're always planning for the worst. So that's just like part of my personality. So like, it's just infused into everything that I do. So I guess it made sense that I'm like planning for a crisis in my cocktail book as well. And the underlying kind of assertion of the book is that there are some pretty standard rules for what makes drink taste good. And then there's a couple different dimensions of how drinks are good. You know, they're kind of structurally well made, but then they also like are suitable to you, like as if from an emotional like standpoint, experiential standpoint. Like, you know, you can make a really good eggnog, but like you're not going to want to bust out an eggnog like in the middle of a hot beach. Like it's just not going to, it just doesn't work. You know, how good their eggnog is technically, it's just not going to be right. So it's kind of about, you have these underlying reasons about why drinks taste good, and you can apply those rules to various different situations, and they apply across whether you're going to make something really fancy and elaborate with really expensive ingredients, or if you're just throwing something together for yourself and you don't really give a shit. So the chapters are all about the way you're feeling. So there's like feeling classic and feeling fancy and feeling lazy. And, you know, something I've always had these like fun stories of like times when I was like, kind of like put myself in a really difficult situation to make drinks and ended up turning out like a decent outcome. And it just goes to show that if you kind of think about what you're trying to do at the end goal, you don't have to worry too much about how you get there. It's just like being resourceful and like, oh, well, this drink needs to be shaken somehow. Like, do I use like a quart container? Like, do I use like two mugs held together? You know, you can kind of, if you liberate yourself from like this sort of literal idea about how you're supposed to be making drinks, you can do a lot more. So the feeling desperate chapter was really about like these drinks that like, you know, you can make and they're delicious and they're fun, but they're sort of meant to represent like kind of these like the outer boundary of like these situations where like even if you think that you're not going to be able to make something delicious, you can really do more than you thought you could and you can have fun doing it. So you don't need to be behind the bar at some super fancy cocktail bar in order to put together a beautiful cocktail that you enjoy drinking. You can be like stuck at a, you know, at a dive bar and make a Michelada, or you can like, you know, I have a whole flowchart of how to make drinks when you're like faced with like a very bleak liquor cabinet, and just these sort of very easy things you can do to just like zhuzh up your drinks a little bit so that you're just having more fun.
Sorry, Hannah. I just want to know, John, what's an example of one of these desperate situations you've been in, and what did you make?
He quarantined for the first couple of weeks in a dive bar in Manhattan, and he was like trying to
shut to the dregs.
Right. Well, I think my prime example of the desperation model of drink making is represented in my in the flowchart about being stuck at your in-laws, and it's based on like a real a real experience that I had where I was visiting my mother-in-law and her husband, and they don't really drink like hard spirits, and so they had this like strange like dusty liquor cabinet on the third floor of their house that had like Stoli from so old that it was said from the USSR on it, and like all these odd liqueurs, and I was sort of like, what's something I can do with this that isn't like just drinking spirits out of a glass? And that kind of was the genesis for like how to like walk someone else through that. And
you need to send Hannah this flowchart like ASAP. Hannah, aren't you like in the process of cleaning out an old liquor cabinet here?
Oh, babe, it is cleaned out.
There's
a bottle of vermouth that is fully become. It is now sherry.
Wow.
It has a price tag sticker that's so old that the like magnum bottle of Dolan vermouth that has never been refrigerated is, the price tag says $5. So we can work backwards, you know, the cost of inflation of how old that is.
Yeah.
Wow.
That's about all that's left.
that's impressive. I would love to see that bottle. So John, that flowchart that you mentioned, you were doing a really cool kind of promotion's not the right word, but you were offering if people were donating money to Restaurant Workers Community Foundation that you were going to give them a sneak peek of the book and give them that flowchart, because like we mentioned, it's an important time to have something like that. We're not able to run to the liquor store anytime we want to. But talk a little bit about that and sort of. This is my transition to talking about RWCF and all the work you've been doing.
So I'm the co-founder of the Restaurant Workers Community Foundation. And I started, we've talked about this before with you all, but we started the foundation a couple of years ago, kind of officially launched in 2018. And it was about sort of finding some structural solutions to some of the really deep issues that were facing the restaurant industry and creating very, you know, negative quality of life outcomes for workers in the industry, and low wages, like high rates of suicide, substance abuse, you know, sexual violence at the workplace, like, you know, every kind of social justice issue is sort of magnified in the food system. And so we kind of were chugging along. We were, you know, building steam and getting, you know, raising our budget and growing our community. And then the coronavirus crisis happened, and it became very clear that there was going to be a significant disruption to the restaurant industry for a long time, and that there were going to be a lot of people who were going to be in need of a lot of like immediate relief and just like for, you know, actual survival, and there needed to be something to specifically respond to that. So we developed a fund that goes to provide emergency financial assistance to people in crisis. We're funding nonprofits and other service providers who are providing relief to people who are in the restaurant industry who are facing a hard time, like people who are doing food kitchens, people who are providing mental health resources, immigration. You know, a lot of domestic and intimate partner violence is happening right now because everyone's stuck at home and really stressed out. So we're providing support to RAIN, and we're actually about to launch to announce a new raft of funds. Of grants going out in the next couple of next week or so, and then the last portion of the fund is going to a no collateral, zero interest loan program, and that's for small businesses who are looking to get kind of back up and running and on their feet again, just giving some easy money to help get through some tough times. And so that was March 15th. And since then we've raised over $6 million in the fund, which is like really astonishing. And it's not something that we ever, a number that we ever thought we'd get to for years and years. And, that's just given us a really huge accelerated time frame for the growth that we were kind of expecting to happen over the next five or so years. It kind of all happened in 10 weeks. And it's been just, we have a volunteer who has been managing our like info at email account. And she says that it's like really hard to, when we get people who are asking us for help, that it's like, you know, kind of hard to read, but also at the same time, there's also so many people who are reaching out for help. So in a way it's like very grounding to be kind of at the center of the problem, to know that there is like the resources and the help that are out there are getting to the right people. So that's just been sort of my life for the last 3 months. And I thought it would be fun to raffle off or to sell off like a few pages of the book. And I thought that the in-laws flowchart was the best one to do because it gave people a very practical guide for like, okay, so do you have this? Yes or no? Yes. Okay. Now I can do these five drinks. Or like, no, but I have Frangelico. It's like, okay, well you have these five drinks, and sort of giving people a way to kind of, have like a fun sort of navigational experience towards a cocktail without having to go outside or do any special shopping. Just felt very appropriate. So yeah, I did that. That was really fun. And I'm also raffling off a lot of people asking me about signed copies. And we don't have a way to sell people signed copies right now. Probably will soon. And so rather than kind of, I've given a few copies from my publisher to do what, you know, as I please. And I thought that it would be great to raffle off a few signed copies for people who donated to Restaurant Workers Community Foundation. So it's kind of like a raffle. If you donate, send me the receipt. And for every $30, I'll give you like one entry. And then I'm going to pick 15 people who get signed copies from me next week. So yeah, I'm just milking my book for for everything I can get for the foundation. Yeah.
That's awesome. So I'm curious now, you know, I didn't realize you guys had hit the 6 million mark. I mean, every time I get an update, it's like you're past another million, which is incredible. What are you all thinking right now, you know, as you start to move from really immediate relief needs for restaurant workers to a longer term, you know, looking at how the industry needs to change and adapt. And obviously these are things that you and the foundation have been thinking about for a really long time, but now it seems like we have an opportunity and opening in a way that we didn't a few months ago.
Yes.
So how are you thinking about how we go forward from here?
Yeah, I mean, I think about that a lot. And it does seem a little bit, you know, a little bit like, it's like, I'm not happy this happened, obviously, but it's a really good, like, it feels like the same way you would feel about like a forest fire or something where there's like, yes, it's destructive. And yes, like a lot of bad things happened, but that doesn't, it's going to happen and it already happened and there's no going back. So do you want to restore things to the way that they were, or do you want to use it as an opportunity to create the kind of deep structural changes that you were kind of thinking about needing 2 years ago, because these problems that we've been dealing with have been in place in the restaurant industry, you know, for decades, if not centuries, in many cases. So, you know, now that there's been this sort of clearing out and this very unfortunate, very painful destruction, literally, we're using it as an opportunity to kind of put in place and to kind of rebuild the industry in a way that prevents these things from happening. Like 40% of the restaurant industry before this, they were living at or near the federal poverty line, which is just a huge amount of people if you think about the fact that there's about 16 million people who are working in the restaurant industry. So it's a ton of people who are really not doing well. And I don't want to go back to that. That doesn't seem like a desirable place to go. So how do we put in place protections for workers? How do we center the worker in the recovery effort? And rather than try to see how we can shore up people's balance sheets and help shareholders keep their value, which is like, okay, that's great. But like, if you have these people who are the main engine of the value that your company is creating, you have to center those people because they're the ones who actually make your business happen every day. And that's so, so important in the restaurant industry because you can't replace people, you know, with a robot. You can't really automate away the experience of like going into a restaurant or a bar and like talking to a person. Like that social element is so important. So if those people who are providing this really valuable emotional and social function in your life are sick, are poor, are, you know, have their kids aren't taken care of, their mental health is terrible, then you don't want to go to that restaurant. You don't want to go to that bar. You don't want to go to that coffee shop. So if you start with the worker and make sure they're taken care of, then I really believe that that's from where everything else is going to come from. So if you prioritize that and make sure that these people are taken care of and paid well, and are given the legal protections and, you know, everything that we think that we need, like Medicare for all and paid sick leave, family leave, like childcare, all these things, I think that a lot of the other problems that we've been seeing, as far as like unsustainable business practices will start to fade away because the core of the business of the industry is healthy and taken care of.
Absolutely. So let's take a really quick break and then we'll come back and we want to talk a little bit about an upcoming event we are doing, Queer the Table Live, that you're going to be participating in. So we will be right back with more with John DeBerry.
My name is Brandon Hoy, co-owner of Roberta's, a super duper awesome place. Roberta's is a very, 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 very proud sponsor of the Heritage Radio Network. We're also super awesome. Thank you, Heritage.
All right. Welcome back to HR and Happy Hour. We are here with our guest, John DeBerry. And okay, so Hannah, would you take it away and tell us about this very exciting event we have coming up that was meant to be in person, but now it's going to be virtual and we're just as excited about it.
Absolutely. Yeah. So this was supposed to happen in April, but as we all know, the world ended in April. John will be joining us for a very special live virtual edition of our podcast, Queer the Table. And he'll be joined by esteemed guests like Andre Springer, who's the founder of Shaquanda's Hot Sauce. And if you're not familiar, you just absolutely should be. Liz Alpern, who is one of the co-founders of Queer Soup Night and is just an amazing activist in the queer food space and just a fabulous person in general. And we'll be also be joined by John, of course. And Nico Whistler is going to be the host. We're doing this in collaboration with the Hetrick Martin Institute, which if listeners aren't familiar, we're going to have two of their team members on the show next week. But they're an incredible nonprofit that provides wraparound services to at-risk LGBTQ youth. So they pretty much provide everything that one might need aside from housing. So right now, their work is more important than ever as so many people are facing food insecurity. But the conversation is going to be about building community in the queer food space. Initially, it was going to be focusing on how we do that in person by sharing a meal, by gathering around a table. But now, as the world has changed, I think, John, especially you have are going to have a lot of insight into kind of how community gets built virtually, as RWCF has done such an amazing job of doing that, mobilizing people to support the hospitality industry during this time. So I'm super excited about this. And if you haven't tuned into Queer the Table, you absolutely should. It's an amazing show.
Yeah.
On that note, just like as kind of a sneak peek of what to expect there, John, what are your thoughts and sort of how a community like hospitality and restaurants that is so based around kind of person to person, face to face contact, like how have you seen community kind of change over the past few months?
That's a good question. It's so, I feel like this is a really hard question to answer because there's kind of this like overlay of like grief and mourning that goes along with it in terms of like, it's not, you know, it's this whole new structure for our society. And, it, you know, I think some of this stuff may stick and some of it might go back to, you know, the way that it, you know, the way that it was in terms of being, you know, in the same room with someone. But it's always been hard to really like double down on a lot of these things because it's like, do you commit to the way things are now and do you let go of the way things were and the kind of thing that you've lost, or do you kind of like pretend that it's like not happening and then, and sort of like hope for the best and kind of like ride it out. So I think a lot of people are feeling that way where it's like you get on a Zoom call, you get on a Instagram live, it can feel a little bleak, but I think at the same time, there's this like very, very like deep level of intimacy that's being built. I think it's on a much smaller scale between people, that maybe you wouldn't have before. And it's like kind of a vague thing that I'm saying, but like for me, it's like when you get on a Zoom call with someone, or Instagram live and you're in their house, you know, and you're not seeing people at this sort of like polished best, you know, like if you're meeting someone at a coffee shop or you're going to dinner or you're doing an event, you know, you have your shit together, you know, you like have your lipstick on, you know, you like wearing your nice clothes and you're not like kind of like shoved in your apartment in like a suboptimal, you know, environment. So you're getting this like very deep look into a person's life. Mm-hmm. And it is very intimate in a way, even if it's not, you know, maybe an event that you would expect to have 100 people come to in person because people like to go to events and meet people. Maybe it's a 20-person event. But I think that as far as the value of the connection that's created in these kinds of things, it's really, really high. And I feel like a lot of like existing bonds or people who are kind of I was friends with sort of acquaintances because you're not relying on like, oh, well, maybe I'll see them again in a couple of weeks. You really have to be really super intentional mm-hmm. about the people you're spending time with. And also like budgeting your screen time because it can get really exhausting. So there's this kind of, it's like a very interesting transition in terms of like, maybe you're not necessarily, you know, reaching hundreds of people or thousands of people, but you're reaching these, you're making sort of these deep connections and you're all kind of going through this like shared trauma essentially. And it sort of creates a kind of a lot of deeper bonds. And I think it also like can maybe strip away some of the superficial elements of community building because people might just show up and not participate in something, or you know, they're just kind of around where in an in-person thing because they maybe they think it might be fun, but like when you're logging on to a Zoom or something or an Instagram live or you know whatever platform you're using, like it's very easy to bail. So the people who do show up, they actually really care.
That's such a good point. And I love that you mentioned the vulnerability of video calls, because that's something I've been thinking about a lot because we've been having so many, is like you get to see someone's like bedroom or living room or office or kitchen or whatever, which you don't normally get to like be in someone's house during a normal like conference call.
Right.
And I'm curious, like, especially going back to what you said earlier about one of your volunteers who's like fielding all of these really emotionally fraught contacts, how are you taking and Michael and your whole team, like how are you taking care of yourselves right now, because I'm sure you have to put some conscious effort into that.
Oh, that's a great question. I think, you know, it's a I think for me, like I kind of like, as I said before, I'm sort of always like psychologically preparing for a crisis, like yeah. to a disordered level, that when there's something like this happening, when there's an actual crisis, I'm actually really good and really calm. And it's kind of like weirdly my element. So for me, it is, you know, there are moments when you're kind of like, wow, this is a total bummer and this really sucks. And like, you know, people are really suffering and like, you kind of have to, you're sort of taking that on. But at the same time, you know, there, like I was in this like flow, whatever state for the first like 2 or 3 weeks of this whole crisis, like for the last weeks of March and like the first couple weeks of April, where I was just like, it was just nonstop. And it was just kind of like, it was like sort of consumed me in a way. And I like kind of was like, I was like doing work at like 2 a.m, which is like something that I never do. Like I work hard, but I know like I should need to stop working. And it's like, you know, I can have these boundaries. And so it did kind of sort of take over my life, and I couldn't stop thinking about it. You know, I couldn't stop talking about it with my husband, who I live with, who I run the, not who I, who he and I, you know, are part of the board, and we were, you know, doing a lot of work for the foundation. I had to really consciously like turn it off, because it wasn't really, it was just getting to be really exhausting and kind of bleak. But at the same time, it's like you're given a chance to not feel helpless. Mm-hmm. And I think that a lot of people were feeling helpless and kind of underutilized, and that we've really grown our volunteer group in these past couple of weeks, because, you know, I'm friends with a lot of restaurant workers and, you know, industry people, and a lot of them are really resourceful, smart people who had great jobs at great bars and restaurants and coffee shops, and then now they don't. And so they have got time, and I think the restaurant industry is filled with people who are really quick thinkers, who are really resourceful, who have a lot of emotional resilience. It takes a lot of emotional labor to be a service industry person, and I don't think a lot of people necessarily always recognize that, you know, to suck it up and smile for 12 hours a day is actually really fucking hard. So we had like a really good core group of people who we've been able to kind of mobilize to help us out. And I think that just being able to do something that feels impactful has been actually like really great, because I think if I was stuck at home twiddling my thumbs, like making sourdough bread for, you know, for weeks on end, I would probably lose it, you know. And actually I think that doing something like this is probably, for me personally at least, the healthiest choice. This whole thing, the Restaurant Workers Community Foundation, came out of another crisis. It came out of this like very, very deep despair I was feeling after the 2016 election. And I was like, fuck, like, what are we going to do? This is going to get so much worse for people before it gets better. So how do we be a part of making that less bad? And for kind of, you know, strengthening the restaurant industry against what was going to happen, you know, at the federal government. So this is kind of like, I'm sort of weirdly in my element right now. So I'm very happy for that. Plus I'm like a super homebody. So being stuck at home is like no sweat for me. So I feel very lucky for a lot of reasons, but yeah.
So one other topic I wanted to make sure that we chatted about, because you very kindly posted on Instagram today that you were coming on the show. And you said we were going to cover a lot of topics, one of which was lipstick. And tying it back to the book, a part of the artwork is like the colors and like the lipstick. Mm-hmm. And before the show started, we were talking about how with like masks are really going to throw a wrench in our lipstick fashion. So what are your thoughts?
It's rough. It's rough. But I feel like... And I think that, like, you know, what a lot of people are feeling right now is that they're so much of like their sort of identity is tied up in the way that they present themselves to the world. And if you don't get seen by other people, it can be really hard to deal with. And so I think even if you don't care about fashion or you're not a flamboyant person, I think that you still want to be, you still have a presentation of who you are. And so it's hard to have to like muffle that, especially if you're living alone, and you're like not making a lot of contact with people. So I, you know, I feel like to me, like I started wearing lipstick because I was like really inspired by this like one character from this like web series. His name was Freckle. Look her up. It's amazing. Freckle. And I just thought it was cool to wear lipstick, and I sort of started using it, and it was just like really fun, and it was like a really great accessory. I'm not a big accessory person, so it's just like one cute thing you can do that just like kind of ties your whole look together. And I like went on a whole like binge of lipstick purchasing in the past like year and a half. But I like sometimes I'll just put on lipstick like for no reason, like just for fun, you know, like just for yourself or like for a Zoom call, or like I'll do like a yoga class and I'll wear lipstick.
And you're doing dramatic readings of your book now too.
Yes.
One there. So like now you have a good reason.
Yeah. So now I have to get, you know, I put on like lipstick at like 6:45 in the morning and like recorded something this morning. Yeah. I just think it looks cool. I think it's just like, I think everyone can use whatever kind of fashion tool that exists to present themselves, and regardless of gender. And I think that this eyelids like look really good with lipstick on. So I'm just going to wear it. And
I think it's like, so not, good to like, oh, sorry.
No, go ahead. I'm just saying I'm not doing it for anybody else but me.
Yeah. I think it's good to like give people permission to see personal adornment as something that's not like purely superficial.
Absolutely.
Like I'm also a big fan of lipstick, and I actually left, I'm at a family home in New Jersey for the last like 3 months, and I'm going back to Brooklyn this weekend, but I left my makeup bag at home. And cause I thought it was sort of an extravagance I wouldn't have time for, but like, I do right. miss it. And like, I love wearing red lipstick, and I've been stuck in this house full of, an old person's clothes, and there are a lot of like colorful ascots.
Ooh.
So instead I've just been like wearing like ascots in my hair. That's my new lipstick. Yeah. But I think that's so important. Cause like, you know, yes, the fashion industry is crazy and puts a lot of pressure on people, but adornment has been a part of human history just as, you know, alcohol and food and all the other fun stuff. And it's such an important part of how we like connect with one another and express yes. ourselves.
Right. Mm.
The mask, right. The mask, like it does put a damper on lipstick maybe, but it also gives permission for absolutely wild off the wall colors, because you now have a chance, you have a chance for the reveal. Like you could be in a room with someone for a minute and then be like, well, bam, you didn't expect that when you take the mask off. Assuming you ever take the
mask off. But you have to get the right kind of lipstick that won't get smudged.
Wait, what?
Just put the lipstick on the mask.
Yeah. But I don't know. And I'm seeing a lot of masks as adornment as well, but it just,
absolutely. Yeah.
I don't know. It's like, it's beautiful. And it's also just so stark.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And your facial posture, whatever your facial expression is, such an important part of like how people relate to you. And like, it's like this kind of very isolating kind of to be physically cut off with someone by, you know, your face, you know, think about how uncanny it was, like that neighbor in Home Improvement who you never saw the guy's face. It's just his eyes. And it's like, that was this whole gag that you never really knew. It's so mysterious that this person was there. And if you can't like see someone's mouth or their nose or the way their cheeks are shaped, it's just like, you don't know what they're thinking.
Yeah.
And it's kind of like, it's exhausting. And you're like, oh, is this someone I know? Or is this just someone who looks like who's 30% of their face looks like someone I know? You know? So you like kind of have these uncanny experiences where you think you're bumping into someone that you know. And then you're like, whoop, nope, just kidding.
Yeah. It's affecting me now because like I have a 4 and change month old baby who is starting to recognize people and is starting to be afraid of faces and masks that he sees. And it's so weird. And you're like, oh, but of course this like tiny developing human needs to see facial expressions to learn how to be in the world. But just to see this like look of fear on his face the other day, we went to the pediatrician and it was just instant. And I was like, oh my God, what is this world?
Wow.
That's a really interesting thing. I wasn't thinking about that at all. Wow. I think I was thinking that everyone having to wear masks means we all have to really start practicing our smizing.
So
it's so disconcerting, really. Like it just, and I was thinking about this and Zoom and like video calls and how, you know, like body language is so much bigger than people's faces. And like, I feel like I'm the kind of person who's like, what are people doing with their hands? And like, how are they breathing? And it's very weird to have like vulnerable conversations with friends who are having a hard time and like not be able to see their whole body.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Totally. And the mask thing especially, like, it's unnerving.
Yeah.
But necessary. Please wear masks.
It's necessary. Right. Everyone wear masks. Absolutely. I'm seeing a lot of people.
Don't get us wrong.
So, okay, well, it's that time of the show where, John, we have a new game. You've really played many, many, many more games on HR and Happy Hour than many people because we invented a game for you.
What got invented for John?
We played a game called Jack Handy Quote or John DeBerry Tweet, where we it was amazing. Go back and find that episode. But what we're doing a new game in our virtual happy hours because we can't see what you can see, and so we're playing a version of 20 questions where we're going to ask you to pick an item. I guess you're in.
He's a radio professional.
So you can pick an item in your mind in your apartment, and then we're going to try to play 20 questions and guess what that item is.
Okay.
So you let us know when you have something in mind.
I got it.
Okay, great. All right.
That's decisive.
Yes or no questions, right?
Yes or no questions. All right, so if someone can kick it off, I'll keep track of number of questions.
Dylan, you always have the best first question.
Yeah, Dylan, you're going to...
I was also going to nominate Dylan.
Shine in HR and happy hour. Except for the last really bad ones. All right. I will ask, is it bigger than your head?
Usually it's a bread box.
No, we've switched ahead because someone got confused by the bread box question.
The bread box doesn't resonate the same way anymore.
That's a yes.
It's a yes.
Is it decorative? This question has gotten us far in the past.
Yes.
Of course.
Wait, hold on. Matt, for future, I think we should ask, is it like solely decorative or is it like solely functional? I don't know.
I mean, what kind of design? Okay, fine.
I feel like everything in John DeBerry's place is going to be decorative, but also useful.
Also functional?
Yes. It's going to be beautiful and functional. And sometimes just beautiful.
Okay, so it is decorative, but do we want to narrow it down further by asking, is it art?
Well, I think we should ask if it's functional.
Okay.
I think, is it art is so existential?
Yeah, is it art? It's hard to answer.
Is it functional, but... Like aesthetic beauty is a. Are we saying
I know. I just went on a whole tangent about that. God damn it!
language.
My fault.
And on today's episode of HR and Happy Hour, we can't play our 20 questions game because we've spiraled into a
band
broken psychological people.
The band breaks up over 20 questions. Like 3 questions in.
Should we say like? Is it a tool? Like a tool?
I think we need to know where it is. I want to.
My God! Thank you, Dylan. Okay.
I would like to know if it's hanging on a wall.
No.
Okay.
Is it food related?
Food or drink?
No.
Is it a light fixture of any kind?
No.
Does it have a soft texture?
Yes.
Ooh, good one, Kate. Okay, it's soft, it's decorative.
Wait, is it animate?
Yes.
Oh, we struggled with this one.
Oh, yes!
It's alive! It's the kitty?
Yes.
Oh, you have a decorative cat.
I was facing the wall and I turned around when I was supposed to look for something and he's just there staring at me like, what are you doing in this closet? And, like, judging me for standing here. So I was like, well, I guess. Now he's gone. Okay.
Oh.
Cats are definitely decorative, not functional.
Jeff.
Everybody does that.
What's your category?
But is it art?
Yeah.
That's a good question. Yeah.
Most assuredly.
That's, yay, Felix.
Yay!
Send us a picture of Felix and we'll use it as the episode art.
Oh, yes, definitely. I have so many pictures of Felix.
I'll get one on Instagram.
Go team. Was that a record, Kat? How many questions was that?
That was good.
It was only like 6 or 7.
Whoa.
I thought you weren't going to get it, and I was like, eh, here's my cat. And then you were like, oh.
And then... So. And then I think that means we have to leave this episode off on a cliffhanger. The next time John comes back on the show, he has to tell us about the time Felix almost killed him.
Oh God!
Ooh. Oh wait, which time? Oh no, that time. Okay.
Oh my God! Cat owners are nuts.
Listen, or at the time Matt, killed, you just don't understand.
Or at the time he killed something.
Thank you so much for coming on the show. Yeah, I feel like we've covered so much amazing ground, and it's always such a pleasure to have you on the network. And thank you for everything that you're doing with Restaurant Workers Community Foundation. And let's end with you telling people where they can go to donate and help continue your work.
Okay, so Restaurant Workers Community Foundation, our website is restaurantworkerscf.org. Or you can go to our Instagram, RWCFUSA, and that we're all right there. Or in my Instagram, JND3001, and I have a link in my bio that goes to the foundation. It also has a good place to pre-order my book. RestaurantWorkersCF.org, and there's a donate button like right there, or Instagram.
Awesome. And then for people who want to pre-order and buy your book, once the book is out, should they just go to your Instagram for the correct links to buy it from independent booksellers? Or
yeah, it's all there. I link to my publisher, and they have links to different purchasing platforms. So that's the best way to go through, and that's also on my my Instagram. Or it's just like search "Drink What You Want" John DeBerry, and it's like the first thing that pops up is the Penguin page for me. So.
Awesome.
And how can people attend the Queer the Table live event or a virtual event?
It is on Eventbrite. So you can search Queer the Table on Eventbrite. It'll be going out on our socials and newsletter as well, but searching Eventbrite is probably the easiest.
Yep. And RSVP there because you'll have to get a Zoom link to join us.
Yes.
That's right. John, I feel like you're always 8th, up to right? like lots of things, and I can't wait to check in and see what is coming next, because I know there's like always going to be lots of projects in the pipeline.
Oh, yeah. All right.
It's always something.
Well, this has been HR and Happy Hour. Thanks everybody. And
we'll
be back next week with the team from Hetrick Martins Institute, and we'll talk more about the Career at the Table event.
Thanks, y'all.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks, John.
HR and Happy Hour is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.